boogeyman is real, and you found him.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
What's blood for, if not for shedding?
I'm your number one fan.
I like to dissect girls. Did you know I'm utterly insane?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
7 days.
I am Dracula.
We have such sights to show you.
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains.
I am the eater of wounds and of children.
What's in the fucking box?
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
One by one, we will take you.
Never gonna happen again!
You gotta be fucking kidding.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else gets the hose again.
Welcome to prime time, bitch!
Welcome, welcome, horror fans. It is Wednesday, 7 p.m. Central Time, and that means it's time for another episode of the Week in Horror Podcast, the only podcast that knows you're there because it can smell your brains. And if you, dear horror fanatic, are listening to us at the top of the week, remember, we do this live every preceding Wednesday right here on YouTube. So we hope to see you in the live chat. This week, we are looking back at select horror films released January 21st through January 27th. Thank you all so much for joining me for what will surely be a bloody good time. I am JL, and I am holding down the fort here at the studio. I hope all of you are doing fantastic out there. So, man, oh man, yes, I have to say this first and foremost, I am feeling a lot better than I was last week. My energy level is way better than it was. And I'm a bit more focused, and hopefully it will be a bit of a better show because, you know, solo shows are tough enough as it is, but when you're not feeling well, they take a toll. They really, really do. So before we kick off tonight's fun, let's see. First, let's get up that amazing Patreon banner. Those are all those amazing individuals who help us to make the show possible. Thank you very, very much for all of your support. We do appreciate that. All those names going down there. Oh, up, wrong way, that way. That direction there. So we appreciate that support up there. Some big stuff that's currently going on. Right now I'm solo because the guys are currently, like, literally are in a meeting. Like, I think as we speak, like, at a sit-down right now, which is really, really important. So I don't know what the details will be, and I don't know if either of them or any of them will stop by after the meeting is over. I don't know how long it will last. But it's a pretty big thing for us in behind the scenes. Hopefully there'll be some big news that'll follow along with that. I don't know. So, like, I'm kind of in the dark myself. I know that they're having the meeting, they're having a big sit down right now, but I don't know what the circumstances are. I don't know what's going to happen. So I'm as excited as y'all are as to what could possibly come, you know, in the future. Who knows? Don't know, but it'll be exciting. Maybe one of them will pop by. Maybe Eugene or Johnny will you know, pop in to give us a heads up to see what the heck is going on, if they can. Or maybe they'll tell me after the show's over, back, you know, when we're all done, and I'll find out then. Who knows? But it'll be pretty cool. I'm hoping. Fingers crossed. So, let's see who we have in the chat tonight. I see I've already got some messages that came in starred. You can already tell that I'm already feeling better. So this is you know, shaping up to be a much better show than it was last week. So my apologies for that last one. First and foremost, we have Raven Darkstar's up. Good to see you, Raven. Thanks so much for being here. First in the chat, Case Cooper as well. Good to see you, Case Cooper. Sherry Tilly says, hey guys, JL, I hope you're feeling better. Thank you very much, Sherry. I am feeling much better than I was last week. Last week was just rough, you know, but fortunately, a lot of sleep, a lot of fluids, a lot of sitting down, and a lot of laying in bed and watching horror movies and, you know, catching up with everything. And I'm feeling a heck of a lot better than I was. Not to mention, you know, and I'm finally back in the gym regularly. I'm working out again, so I've got the energy going. So really, really pleased that I'm feeling better than I was last week. So hopefully, you know, it was weird because last week I did the show and, you know, I was like zonked and I was just like, you know, I was kind of like on the upswing, but I still wasn't feeling great. I was like at 70%, 60%, I don't know. But I actually, the show ran like perfectly, like 2 hours, like just like 2 hours and a couple of minutes. And typically when I'm feeling good, I sometimes will rush when I'm solo. So the show won't be as long. It's weird. So apparently, to get a show that lasts 2 hours, I have to not be feeling well, so that I take my time and I go slowly. But I'm kind of excited now because we got some good ones to talk about. We do. Some good movies that came out this week in horror history. So let me see. Who else do we have here as well? I see. Oh, they were taking, yeah, Casey Cooper, 30 minutes. Will it be a go? Will it start on time? Yep, starting on time, because, you know, if it's just me, it's always going to start on time. Sue Me, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight. I appreciate it. Appreciate you being here. Travis Brown is there hanging out. Says, evening, y'all. I just watched Destroy All Neighbors and Renfield this past weekend. And while Renfield is goofy, I still prefer the over-the-top goofiness of Studio 666. Both of them are decent. I thought Renfield was a little kind of like on the nose. And it's interesting that you bring that up, because we have a film that we're going to, well, actually, we have a little something before we dive in tonight that is kind of tangentially linked to what Universal is trying to do over at, you know, with their Universal Monsters franchise. I, you know, we have some more details coming up, so it should be interesting. But good to see you, Travis Brown. Thanks so much for hanging out tonight, as well as Sarcasm says, good evening. Thanks so much, Sarcasm, for being here as well. Elizabeth S., good to see you. Thanks so much for being here. Ivy Gentry, good to see you as well. Rodinola's name, Gab Gabbitoo, says, drawing and quartering really tears family apart. Yes, it does. Typically into four equal-sized pieces. Joshua Lee is here. Good to see you. Says, evening, everyone. And Sally Skellington as well. Says, hey, everyone. Good to see you, Sally. And thank you so much to Casey Cooper, who has been a member of the Army of the Dead for 6 months. Joshua Lee, who's been a member of the Army of the Dead for 6 months. Sarcasm, who's been a member of the Army of the Dead for 6 months. And Angel Rivera, good to see you, who's been a member for 5 months. And yes, you can support the show here on YouTube. You don't have to do Patreon or PayPal or any of that stuff. You could support us with channel memberships. It's like 99 cents a month. You get access to all the cool emojis that I made for you and the channel badge. And of course, you can help, you know, make all the things possible that we do here. So I do appreciate that. All those green names you see, all those individuals who help to make the show possible, we do appreciate that. Thank you very, very much. Yeah, last week was horrible health-wise. Joshua Lee says for himself, but yeah, it was tough. But thank you very much, Case Cooper says, you look like you feel better. Yes, I do. I feel much better than I did. Dib Dib is here, says lurk mode engaged. Good to see you, Dib. Thanks so much for being here tonight. And maybe Sarcasm, maybe, fingers crossed. Yeah, well, like I said, I can't say too much, but I guess we'll find out. Skitch Crasher, good to see you, Skitch Crasher says good afternoon. Thanks so much for hanging out with us. Do appreciate it. As well as Javier Hara says, hello, hello. Good to see you, Javier. Insane Angel as well. Good to see you, Insane Angel. John Monahan says, good evening. Good to see you, John. Thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight. We do appreciate it. Doctor Who Design says, hey, JL. Good to see you, bud. Sir Cap says, I got my Netflix back and started season 6 of Black Mirror today. I'm interrupting my binge to be here tonight. Well, we do appreciate it. Thank you very, very much, Sarcasm, because Black Mirror season 6 is pretty fucking good. So Sarcasm has also been, oh, sorry, Sarcasm has gifted 5 memberships to the Army of the Dead. Thank you so much, Sarcasm. Very, very generous of you. We do appreciate that. Thank you very, very much. Let me see. Who got memberships? Dib Dib got a membership. John Monahan got a membership. Ida Pimp Utaho got a membership. Tinker Phil got a membership. And apparently Bridge the Divide as well. So my personal channel got one as well. So thank you very much, Sarcasm. Do appreciate that. Let me see. Who else we got here? Insane Angels has still got the flu. Ooh, hope you're feeling better very, very soon. Yep, I am a member. And yeah, so I think I got everybody. John Monahan says, thank you, Sarcasm. You are a gentleman and a scholar. Yes, Sarcasm is. Very generous of you. Thank you very, very much. Look at all those new members there. Appreciate it. Yes. Big supportive members. All right. So, I appreciate everybody being here tonight. Hopefully, this is going to be an awesome show, because I'm feeling a hell of a lot better than I was. My beard is a little insane, you know, because I've been catching up, so I didn't really, like, groom my beard, so I've got kind of an Otis Driftwood thing going on at the moment, but hopefully it won't be too out of control. Let me see here. Oh, Travis Brown says, I watched a couple of episodes of Black Mirror, but I fell off the train. You need to get back on that train, good sir. You really, really do. And Dr. Design says, Black Mirror rules. I've watched it 4 times. Black Mirror and Love, Death, and Robots. Love both those franchises. Both of them are fantastic. Casey Cooper says, glad you're on tonight, JL. Just got Agent Rejection 102. Oof. Dude, that's rough. But, you know, hopefully. That's, you know, hopefully very soon you'll get that acceptance. Yeah, hopefully very soon, Casey. And I see Travis Brown says, your Yeti beard to deal with the cold. Yes, my Yeti beard to deal with the cold. it works, you know, it's good, but it's a little unruly tonight. It really is. So hopefully it won't get you know, too much of a mind of its own. Well, thank you, John. I appreciate this. Your beard looks better than mine. Well, thank you very much. All right. So tonight, and I'm kind of bummed because I know the guys are doing important things. They're in the middle of something right now, but there is a new trailer that just recently came out that is kind of interesting. And not just what the movie is or what the movie is about, but of course, kind of the backstory on it as well and how this thing got made. So, but I saw the trailer and I knew I was going to have to show it to y'all in case y'all hadn't seen it yet. But I went ahead and grabbed it so that we could watch it now. And it is the trailer for the upcoming horror film, Abigail. So if you haven't seen it, be sure to check it out here. But let's cue up this terror tube and let's check it out for ourselves. So yes, that was the trailer for the upcoming horror film, Abigail. So interesting stuff about this one. So it's set for release April 19th, 2024. The film focuses obviously on, you got it pretty much in the trailer, a group of kidnappers who capture and must watch over the daughter of a powerful figure until they get more than they bargained for, when it's revealed that Abigail is a vampire child and gets hunting them one by one through the house. So, well, yes, but Rodinola's name says, damn, after Megan, every monster has to dance now. And I think it works. It really, really does. So I love the trailer for this one. I think it looks like it's shot awesomely. I cannot wait to see this particular one. The film stars Melissa Barrera, recently off of Scream 6, who recently left the franchise, for whatever reasons. And then Alicia Weir, who plays Abigail. Dan Stevens, Catherine Newton from Supernatural fame and Freaky fame, and of course, Kevin Durand, who is one of my favorite character actors, Angus Cloud, rest in peace, who recently passed away last year, and of course, Giancarlo Esposito, Gus Fring himself. So awesome, awesome cast. Now, the production behind this is really fascinating because the people behind it are you saw from the trailer, the people behind Freaky and of course Scream and Ready or Not and Scream. And that was Radio Silence Productions. Radio Silence Productions, which is a group of individuals that include Matt Bettinelli Open and Tyler Gillette with Chad Vieva. And pretty much that group, after the success of Scream 5, Scream 6, and of course Ready or Not with Samara Weaving. If you remember that one about the girl brought in for the hide and seek that turned to do a human sacrifice thing. So they, with their incredible success, they were approached by Universal to develop a monster film that would fall kind of in line with their kind of modern day adaptations of the Universal classic monsters. And for those who are really, really familiar with that, this film is technically a reimagining of the 1936 film Dracula's Daughter. And so with a new twist of them trapped in the house with the entity itself. And so I'm kind of liking where they're going with this. Now, the film is standalone. It is not intended. Originally, it was envisioned to be kind of connected to the 2017's Mummy. But after the failure of that film, they decided to kind of like go more in an Invisible Man, where they have standalone films that are not necessarily a part of the same universe, but could potentially in the future as a part of Universal's dark universe plans. So really, really interesting going with this one. There's a kind of like singular, Universal stated that they kind of want a singular continuity with this film as they have with The Mummy, where they have everything kind of rooted in there and they're trying a brand new approach, whereas they're allowing these individuals to come in and tell their own stories, utilizing the IP and not necessarily focus on trying to build a cinematic universe. And I think that Universal finally got it in their head that not everything has to be a connected universe in order to be successful or be popular. Because The Mummy, not great. Invisible Man, developed by Blumhouse, fantastic. Renfield, not bad. So, and now we have a really excellent pedigree of filmmakers and cast who are behind this one. And I'm really, really looking forward to this. The question then is, given that, you know, failure, you know, it was cruised. I love that Raven Dark Star. He says, no, failure, it was cruised. Yes, it was cruised. And by the way, thank you, Raven Dark Star. I appreciate that. I know I sent you that PDF, and I hope that you're enjoying it. There's some big edits coming along with that. Tang Whistle really, really helped me out with that. as far as some editing that needed to be done. So what you have is not the final copy of that, but I do hope you're enjoying the short stories that I wrote. So I hope you're digging those. I hope they're creepy as shit. Hey, Lexan, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out with us tonight. I always appreciate seeing new faces. I don't remember seeing Lexan before. Maybe I just forgot, but I'm glad you're here. And Jinju as well. Thanks so much for hanging out, Jinju. This looks like an imagination into what Claudia would have been like had she lived. Interesting. Very cool. Very Anne Rice reference there. I like that. So I'm very, very excited because it's got a bunch of actors that I really, really love in this. Melissa Barrera, I've enjoyed, I liked her in the Scream films and the other films that she's done. Kevin Durant is one of my favorite all-time character actors, you know, and you've spotted him here and there across the board. He's been in so much. As a matter of fact, he's in one of the movies we're talking about tonight. So he had a little character role in one of those. And so then it goes newcomer Alicia Weir, who is a classically trained dancer, actor, and singer, who is best known for playing Matilda in Matilda the Musical. So, and then, of course, Catherine Newton. And Giancarlo Esposito, because if you got Gus Fring, yeah, you can't go wrong with that. Lori Marie, thank you so much, Lexianne. Excellent. It was probably a new name. It wasn't clicking with me. So the question is, are y'all excited for Abigail? So we just watched the trailer for the upcoming horror film Abigail coming out April 19th of this year. So if you are looking forward to that based upon what we saw in the trailer or what we talked about here, then let us know down in the comments below. If you're excited about this new vampire entry into what looks to be a smashing good time, I'm really, really excited about this one. Very excited. I'd say probably 90-10. 80-20, 90-10 excited about this one because I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So, and I don't think they're going to skimp on the bloodletting and the gore and the violence. I think it's going to be hardcore. So really, really looking forward to it. Definitely. Let us know down in the comments below. Love to hear what you guys think about all that stuff. All right. So now we've got, and San Angel says, I'm looking forward to it. Horror movie night. It's always date night for my hubby and I. Awesome. Sir Gavin says, totally digging it. Awesome. Travis Brown says, not a vampire film fan, but may give it a watch. Yeah, you know you're going to watch it. Same as me. And as Lee says, looks to be really good. I'm looking forward to it. and John Monahan says, I hope the drive-in is open when it comes out. That would be super cool. That would be very cool. Absolutely. All right, well, we've got some, as Alex likes to say, we have some horror movies to talk about tonight. Now, I'm really excited to talk about this first one, because back in season 3, we actually had the director of this movie on the show. So Frank Farrell actually came on to hang out with us, and we talked to, during the After Dark, we talked quite a bit about this film. It's his, you know, it's his one big film, and it recently got a bit of a revival thanks to the, I believe it was, I think it was the Shout Studios, I believe, re-released it in a Blu-ray, re-released it on Blu-ray, and so it got a bit of a revival because of that, and of course, I think Joe Bob as well, I think, or I'm not sure. I know it got a bit of a revival, and he was seeing a nice kind of like, you know, feedback on that one, kind of in a retrospect, because this one came out quite a while ago. So, but this first film we're going to talk about, Shout Factory. Thank you very much, Travis Brown. And so, the first movie we're going to talk about tonight released January 22nd, 1988. And that is the movie Spooky. So this one's for you, Frank. I don't know if you're still listening to the show, but I'm still friends with him on Facebook. Frank is a really super cool dude, really knowledgeable about his shit. And, you know, this was kind of his passion project. He wanted a practical effects driven horror film, and he got one. He made it happen. So let's check out this trailer for Spookies. Cue up the terror tube. Yes, that was the trailer for Spookies. So, an independent horror film. Let me see. Directed by Brendan Faulkner and Thomas Duran and Eugenie Joseph. Written by Thomas Duran, Brendan Faulkner, Frank Farrell, and Anne Berglund, who handled additional material in the reshoots for it. And then, of course, starring Felix Ward, Dan Scott, Alec Nemser, and Maria Pachukas. The film follows a group of partying teenagers, your classic setup, a group of partying teenagers who decide to hang out of this abandoned mansion and become trapped inside as a warlock tries to sacrifice the group with the intention of using their life force to keep his own wife alive. And so eventually winds up transforming a number of them into, killing a bunch of them, utilizing monsters that he's created. And then, of course, you have, like, the dead bodies outside. You're keeping them inside. So the film in and of itself kind of like released with zero, with like very, very little fanfare when it first came out, and then got a kind of a limited theatrical release in in the late 80s. I think it was like in, because originally it was like 86, then saw a little bit of a release 87, then didn't get a big one until like 89 when the USA Network started playing it here and there. And has since then achieved a bit of a cult following, especially thanks to the re-release when that came out. So the film in and of itself, written and produced by Frank Farrell. Frank Farrell was the one we had on the show. He was an amazing dude. And it started out as a film called Twisted Souls, where it was basically the people were being turned into these monsters. And then as it was being basically in, as it was in post-production during the editing process, the film suffered a bunch of like legal and creative issues between the producers and the financial backing, when the financial backer basically absconded with the cash and there was no money to complete everything. And so that's when the additional stuff was brought in order to try and finish the film and get the film finished, finished at all costs. And if you haven't checked it out or haven't listened to it, back in, I believe it was season 3, Frank sat down with us and talked with us extensively about the travails that, you know, he encountered trying to get Spookies done. And so it was one of those, you know, fucked up things that kind of happens on the back end, you know, when you never really know where your money's coming from, or maybe you put a little bit too much faith in, you know, one particular person, and things did not work out the way they had hoped, but they did eventually get the movie itself done. Now, the thing that I think sets Spookies apart is that instead of they minimize the use of like goofy animations, there was some overlay effects where they kind of dropped them on there or try to create kind of like an otherworldly vibe, but it's very much in the vein of a film like another film that's kind of like a guilty pleasure of mine called Cthulhu Mansion, where everything is as practical effects driven as is entirely possible, which is what the producers and Frank specifically wanted. That's what they had in mind. They wanted a practical effects driven monster flick, and they wanted very, very unique monsters. And I have to admit, they're not bad. The monsters in and of themselves, especially the one of my favorites is the big spider monster transformation sequence, which goes from like, you know, this hot, you know, Asian woman into this giant, you know, spidery thing with the big head and the legs and everything. And it was, I really and thoroughly enjoyed what they were able to pull off. The group that was behind it is Gabe Bartalos, Arnold Gargiulo, and Jennifer Espinal and John Dodds all pretty much came together in order to make these monsters happen. So it's the film in itself is actually a lot of fun. Now, I get it. This is what's interesting, is that Thomas Brown brought it up, and I think he said, where was it at? Hey, Left-Handed Jedi, good to see you. Thanks so much for hanging out, as well as Glober Mom. Good to see you. Thanks so much for being here. Says, hi, everyone. Thank you for being here. Yeah, Red Letter Media. Oh, yeah, so Rodolfo Sanfrancisco, Spooky's got a spotlight on Red Letter Media, best of the worst as well. Oh, great, yeah. So the movie in itself, you know, when you compare these things, are not great. Storyline-wise, the film, yeah, I mean, you kind of get you get what you would expect in a movie like this one. The setup is pretty lean. Party teenagers go into abandoned mansion. Abandoned mansion is where this, you know, this old warlock lives, who's the, you know, and he's trying to keep his wife alive by, or trying to kind of like resurrect his wife, and by utilizing their life force, sacrificing him to these creatures that are on the property. And then, of course, they can't escape because of the monsters that are out there, you know, waiting on the outside of the property. So it's not that deep in that one, but for what they're able to pull off with the money that they have, I have to give credit to Frank and the production team behind it for doing everything they could to try and make it happen, and plus sticking to their guns regarding the practical effects, which, according to Frank, some of them were extraordinarily difficult. Some were actually quite easy. But some were so involved and took way longer than they should have to try and pull off, the Spider Woman being one of them. But there were a couple of them that were actually really simple. You have the guys in the full body suits, who, you know, the one sequence you saw with the fart noises, and the undead, the zombies outside. And then, of course, like the Reaper dude, you know, those are, you know, were fairly easy. But there were some really involved stuff, not to mention I really kind of dug the little goblin-y monster things too. Those are kind of, you know, those are kind of funky. So, but I really thoroughly enjoyed that. If you dig 80s style practical effects driven films, similar in the vein to, I'm not gonna say this movie is similar to like Gremlins or Critters or anything of the nature, but that's where you have all the really, really fun practical effects driven shit. The problem with this one is, like, I think the biggest issue that really hampered the film was how the passion that you have to make a movie can inadvertently become kind of like the monster itself, because everyone in this one was so driven. It reminded me, the story behind it reminded me very, very much of a 1982 film called The Forest. And in that particular film, that director was so hell-bent on getting that film done and getting the people on that project paid that he damn near went bankrupt, damn near lost his home. He remortgaged his house and put everything he could possibly have just to get the film finished and just to get his cast and his crew paychecks. He took nothing off of that originally. And so it reminded me of that, of the willingness to, you got to respect that willingness to go broke, go broke or go home, that willingness to do whatever it takes in order to get your kind of like your passion project done. There has to be kind of like a line that you draw in the sand. Now, I know that some people say that's heresy. You don't draw a line when it comes to your creative vision. You make sure it happens. You do it again. The show must go on and such. But a lot of people are, there's a lot of difficulties there, and a lot of people left in limbo, at a certain point when things started breaking down and when there was no money, and it gets tough. And that's what happens when you're kind of blinded by your passion in order to get a project done. But thankfully, I am glad that Frank and the other Frank and the team behind this were able to get that kind of revival for the film. And so, I mean, enough so that, I was able to actually get a Spooky's t-shirt that I wore during when we had him on the show. And pardon me. And that was kind of the killer. That was kind of the kicker on that one. I thoroughly enjoyed the love that goes into it. You can tell that they had a lot of fun making the movie. And I just wish that they kind of hadn't gotten in their own way. And desperation can make people do really, really crazy stuff, especially when trying to get shit done, especially when rushing stuff. The monsters that I thought were really, really cool in this one. You have the Demon Ouija Girl, you have the Muck Men, which are the ones that are doing all the farting and everything. You have the Spider Woman, which is like arguably one of the best in there. The snake demon things, the hallway demon, the Grim Reaper, who's the dude, the big, he looks like a Grim Reaper. And the zombies that we're seeing outside on the property. And so the fun stuff, I would say, go into this one. You've heard about it on Red Letter Media. Joe Bob, who said he didn't really understand it because the narrative is really kind of loose. They play fast and loose with it. The thing that I think will put a bunch, like, ooh, the gate. The gate's another one. The gate is another fantastic example. The biggest issue on this one was I could see the difficulties they had in trying to juxtapose the monster aspects of the film with the warlock stuff, with the guy, because it's two completely different tones. And that is another kind of thing that kind of trips the production up. And some of you kind of like, well, I want to get back to the monsters and get back to the fun, enjoyable stuff, because the stuff with the warlock is really, really maudlin and kind of drags. And so despite the fact that it's shot well, the biggest issue is that you had two different shooting effects, kind of like two different cinematography styles going into each one, which tell two stories that they're trying to link, but tonally that really kind of throws the movie off a little bit. And it comes off as kind of disjointed because you had so many cooks in the kitchen, which is another thing that kind of got in its way. So unfortunately, not a whole ton there. Watch this one specifically for the practical effects, just to see what they were able to pull off with the small amount of money that they had and the dedicated crew and talent that they had behind the practical effects team, which is really, really fantastic. Am I the only one with a frozen JL? I'm not frozen. I'm good. Okay. Everybody's saying that the stream is solid. Okay, cool. Yeah, just want to make sure everything is good. All right. So, this one is available. I mean, you can check it out online. It's available via Amazon Prime right now, and you can definitely check it out that way if you're willing to rent it. I say rent it because little independent films like this, especially when Vinegar Syndrome released Spookies on Blu-ray and DVD with the 4K restoration of the film, it looks solid. I mean, it looks really, really good, and I strongly recommend because, they put their heart and their soul into it, and they deserve to get paid for it. So I rented it myself, and I'm going to find it. I don't I have a Blu-ray player, but I don't typically buy on Blu-ray, but I'm thinking about picking what's up. I'm thinking about picking up a copy myself, but if you're going to check it out, definitely rent it. Definitely rent it, and let's get some dollars in those guys' pockets, because they deserve it. They absolutely do. I know that the shirt that I bought did not go there, because it was kind of one of those unlicensed ones you get at a horror convention. But yeah, and definitely check out season three, the episode that we had with Frank Farrell and the After Dark that we had with him, because we dive deep into the backstory of Spookies. And, you know, there's so much there and so much that Frank could say. And I'm doing kind of like a really, really quick sum up here, because I don't want to take too much away from him. And I would like everybody to hear it in his words, you know, what he brought to it, what the experience was like, and what it was like after so many years to all of a sudden, boom, it's suddenly back on people's radar again. He's getting a nice little resurgence, which I think is always really, really cool. Yeah. Supporting physical media. Definitely. Always. Free with ads on Sling. Yes, it is. Thank you, Sarcasm. Appreciate that. Also, if you can, watch the Joe Bob episode of Spookies on Shudder. Absolutely. Number of ways that you can see it. Otherwise, it's a fun little film. It's fun. It's got good energy. It's a little tonally weird. It's a little weak on the narrative, but that's not the reason we watch these things. We watch these things for the crazy practical effects, and that Spider-Woman is worth watching. That Spider-Woman technique, the whole mutation thing, where it's, you know, ballooning out into this giant monster and all the webbing and everything, it's worth it. That sequence alone makes it worth it. So definitely jump in there if you haven't had an opportunity. Sarcasm says, this week's front row was a great combo too. Thanks for that one, JL. I learned much. My pleasure, Sarcasm. Glad that you enjoyed that. This was a really, really good front row that we had with Sean Heights. Sean Heights was an amazing guest and so many cool things. You know, I mean, the guy knows his stuff. He loves horror as much as any of us do. And that one was a lot of fun. I'll just say that. So check that out. That just went live on the channel. But the question being, one thing that I really, really enjoyed about Spookies was the variety of monsters in this. Typically, with not a lot of money, you can get maybe one, two, maybe push it and get three monsters, maybe. And the more monsters you get, the less variety you're going to get, and the less detail you're going to get. But there were lots in this movie, lots of different ones that were all kind of, you know, very unique in their own style. So my question is, because I talked about it so much, what was y'all's favorite Spookies monster? Favorite monster to appear in the film. My favorite out of all of them was the Spider-Woman, because it was so unique and I really enjoyed the mutation sequence, and it was so in depth and so high detail, and I really, really enjoyed it. So that's my favorite. But like Travis Brown says, the farting poop monsters, the muck men. Yes. So everyone's got kind of like that favorite that they think is really, really cool. So let us know down in the comments below, or weekendhorror@gmail.com, or here in the live chat, what was your favorite monster, your favorite practical monster in the movie Spookies? Because I think we've all got our own kind of favorites that kind of speak to us, you know? Let's see. Travis Brown says, also the Spider-Woman. Hell yeah, Spider-Woman was good. Oh, Casey Cooper says, I give JL, what is the horror tie-in to Department of Literature? It is, because you know me. You know me. I've Lovecraft all day long. So it's Miskatonic University. Miskatonic University's Department of Literature. So, because you know what's kept in there. Yep. Yeah, Sir Gabs says, the transformation of the Spider-Woman was the freaking shit. Yes, it was. Very, very cool stuff. Very cool stuff. Definitely check it out if you haven't had an opportunity. So, all right. But definitely want to hear what you guys think. What your favorite monster was in Spookies. Of all the variety that we got in there, what was your favorite in the film? Let me know down in the comments below. All right. We are trucking along. Let's jump on to our next film. This one is kind of interesting. I got to give it to him. So, released January 23rd, 2004. A minute ago. We have The Butterfly Effect. Now, I know Eugene would hate this because it's a mid-2000s, you know, it's in that vein of film, but this one's actually not too bad. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the Terror 2. Yes, that was the trailer for The Butterfly Effect. So, directed by Eric Bress and J. Mackie Gruber, and written by Eric Bess and J. Mackie Gruber, starring Ashton Kutcher, Amy Smart, Eric Stoltz, William Lee Scott, Eldon Henson, Logan Lerman, Ethan Suplee, and Melora Walters. So the film follows Kutcher's character, Ashton Kutcher's character, Evan Treborn, who, you know, was known for experiencing blackouts and memory loss throughout his childhood. And later in his 20s, he realizes that he has the ability to travel back in time to inhabit his former self during those periods of blackout with his mind inhabiting his younger body. And he attempts to change the present by altering his past behaviors to set things right for himself and his friends. But of course, as the film states, the butterfly effect, there are unintended consequences of all because one cannot see all foreseeable outcomes. And so the this one was kind of fascinating. So I dig the concept. The concept in itself is interesting, the butterfly effect, and how it's been explored in a number of other deals, like Outer Limits touched on it, Twilight Zone touched on it. It's not something that is original in that respect, because the notion of going back and altering one thing and then, you know, the trickle down effect, where you have no idea what could possibly go off, you know, especially going further and further back. And I like the big thing on this one was at the time, and I have to say, this is the importance. The importance of, or I say, okay, first, before I get too deep into that one, I first want to say the performance in this film across the board was actually really, really strong. I found Ashton Kutcher's character was very believable back before he kind of like bought his own hype, and he had an excellent supporting cast in there as well with Amy Smart, Ethan Suplee, and a number of other character actors as well. The film is entertaining to boot. The weakness of the film overall is the writing in and of itself, because characters jump to stuff and they jump to conclusions and make decisions a little bit too easily in this respect. There's some interesting back and forth. The sequence in the prison after he accidentally murders after accidentally beats the guy to death and winds up in prison for involuntary manslaughter. There's interesting sequence there. The prison sequence, the sequence when he goes back, and the CP neighbor who is taking advantage of them. All that varies. There's interesting things that are explored in there, but the writing is never strong enough to really carry through, because we're only getting one aspect of this from Kutcher's perspective. I understand why the writers were attempting to play the story in this way, but it's character driven. In this respect, it's designed to run solely to basically be driven by the character relationship between Ashton Kutcher's character and Amy Smart's character, and then of course seeing the damage it does to his friends around him, as he's the only one aware of what's currently going on. And I really like that it went so far as to, he tried to stop the explosion of the mailbox and wound up, like, you know, losing his arms. And so how the heck can he possibly do this? You know, the shit just keeps getting worse and worse and worse and worse until eventually he figures out that, you know, he's the cause of all of the issues going all the way back, and it does like the time flip. I don't want to, this film's a bit on the old side. And so I don't know if I'm spoiling it for anyone in that, but in the end, you know, in the basically he has to go back and he has to, I think it was in the, that's right, it was in the director's cut. So there's two different cuts to the film. There's the director's cut and there is the theatrical cut. In the theatrical cut, Evan pretty much just, you know, stops, like he basically cuts himself out of Kaylee's life. And so, you know, he never affects her negatively to that degree. And so that was kind of like, I would say, the weaker of the two endings. And in the director's cut, Evan actually goes back and jumps back into his, when he's still in utero, unalives himself. It is 20 years old. Some of us have not seen a jail. I understand that in that respect. But he does that, and in order to stop himself from having the effect that he's had at all. So he basically goes back and cuts himself completely out so that he affects nobody's lives. I thought that one was a little bit of the stronger ending. I thought there's one that should have been released with the director's cut, but you know, that one's, you know, was extremely dark, and that one you can catch on the DVD. You can catch on that release. So I found this one really, really compelling. Now, obviously, we know as an audience, we know a little bit more about how time travel works in that respect, and how changing the events of the past don't change the future, because, and you know, I think it was explained quite well in Avengers Endgame. That's not how time travel works. So yeah, narratively, not the greatest. It's more just a kind of a character study in that respect. But I will say this, and this is the thing that got me the most about this movie, is that at the time, Ashton Kutcher was an up-and-coming name. Amy Smart as well was kind of like one of the go-to girls of the 90s. You remember her in Varsity Blues, a number of other productions as well. And in this particular one, I enjoyed it because all of the actors were... This is a time, I think, in their early careers when they were willing to take risks. And this is the importance of taking risks, which I really enjoyed. Seeing Ashton Kutcher put himself out there to this degree, we haven't seen something like that, because I think it's not as marketable for him. Further along the lines, he's gone more and more on his kind of like that 70s show kind of mentality, that 70s show character that he played there, I believe it was Kelso. And so he's kind of run with that as far as his career goes. But this was back when he had the opportunity. He, you know, interesting scripts came along. He wanted to tell interesting stories. And same with Amy Smart, the willingness to embrace different, extremely different characters and do interesting things. And that's what kind of made the Butterfly Effect, I think, intriguing, was that despite the weak writing, the performances themselves kind of like overtake. The film itself is decently shot, but it's a character-driven piece. And it's designed with, you know, it's got, you know, some freaky, you know, like, you know, stuff, you know, visual effects there, here and there. But overall, it's definitely a character-driven film. It's definitely a character study. And an important note that as an actor, as a director, as a writer, to try and take risks and to challenge the cast that you bring in to try and, you know, break new ground and try new things and not be afraid of what those characters can portray, or, you know, don't worry about the marketing. That's the importance of a movie like this one. I think that makes it really, really good. It's a good marker as to these particular actors, because all of them are so extraordinarily talented. Ashton Kutcher is a very, very talented individual. I love Amy Smart. Ethan Suplee is one of my favorite character actors out there, and a bunch of the supporting characters. I like the willingness to go dark in that. I love the willingness to embrace these dark kind of story, this dark kind of storytelling. And I wish we'd gotten more out of it. Now, I do, you know, somebody did bring up that, you know, I hate that Fred Knotts. Good to see you, Fred. Says, I hate that Amy Smart sort of got blackballed on this. And yes, they're, you know, careers don't always go the way you want them to go, which sucks. And, you know, sometimes people kind of get screwed over. I agree with you, Sarcasm. Donnie Darko did do it better, explored this a lot better, and plus, I think overall had just better actors across the board because of who they had access to, and not to mention that storyline, that's where the writing is really, really good. When your writing is really strong, and you can get someone like Jake Gyllenhaal, Maggie Gyllenhaal, and Drew Barrymore, Patrick Swayze, Jenna Malone, magnificent actors across the board, you know, and of course, with individuals willing to take risks. So, I mean, Donnie Darko did do it better, but then again, the writing on that one was far superior. And so, and plus, it's Jake Gyllenhaal. There's nothing that man can't do. So I will say it kind of played with, you know, I'd say that went down the time travel thing of being able to predict things and a little bit more analytically, whereas Butterfly Effect was more of just kind of like an exploration of the individuals themselves. Yes, Ashton Kutcher can act. Yes, he can. He is capable of so much more than just, you know, that 70s show, Kelso style, the ranch style comedy. He actually has depth and range to it. He just never gets the opportunity to express that. You know, it's like, that's what made him popular. That's where he's going to go. And this is why in his filmography, you don't see a lot of this stuff anymore, you know, because it's not marketable for him, which is a damn shame. Fred Knott says, and why is the Butterfly Effect always a bad thing in stories? The issue being is like, in this particular one, it's bad because what they're expressing there is the self-centeredness of that, is the hubris of thinking that you know better or thinking that you can do better, whether it's fate or whether it's God or whether it's whatever, it doesn't really matter. It's that, oh, and Two and a Half Men. He can act. He chooses not to. Good point, Tony Regime. So is essentially the exploration of man's hubris. The you know, that you think you like, no matter how smart you are, how, you know, there's always variables you can never predict. And this goes into things like, you know, with chaos theory. Remember, Jurassic Park came out in 1993, and kind of like opened that door about things that you can't possibly predict because, you know, things will happen simply because it's possible for them to happen, and you can't predict all outcomes. Well, the same thing kind of plays along these lines. I hate to kind of like put Butterfly Effect in the same sentence with Jurassic Park, but the exploration of chaos theory and Butterfly Effect there, where they kind of touched on it a little bit, the unpredictable outcomes of complex systems. So, yes, Left-Handed Jedi. Playing God usually ends poorly. And this one does. I honestly think they could have gone with the director's cut. I thought that one was a little bit stronger. I thought it was a more fitting ending. And I get they wanted to kind of give the ideas kind of like, oh, well, he just cut himself out of Kaylee's life. Kaylee doesn't know him anymore. And so they do the pass-by scene at the end. But I think the director's cut was so much stronger because it was the willingness to sacrifice in order to make other people's lives, the shedding of the hubris and realizing that if he truly loved Kaylee, he would be trying to make her life better for her. He would try to make her life better for her instead of making her life better for himself to make himself feel better for his own actions. So he just winds up, unmaking himself or dying in the womb, you know? So I kind of I dug that one. That was a little bit better in that respect. But unfortunately, you know, it could have been so much more. It could have been, but the writing itself just kind of falls flat because it's more. I would say more weight is put on, you know, trying to get something out of Ashton Kutcher and the rest of the actors to try and really portray these things in a kind of dark visual style, which at the time was kind of popular. I think Butterfly Effect was a product of the 90s. You know, when that kind of like angstiness was coming up, and he was definitely trying to shed shed that 70s show image. And same with Amy Smart was branching off in new darker territory. Same with Ethan Suplee. So, it's not perfect, but it's an entertaining one, to say the least, I would say. I just wish there was more to it. And the writing is ultimately going to probably annoy a lot of people, which is the damn shame of it. Now, what's interesting is that this is the first one in a trilogy, which many people may not know. But yeah, there was Butterfly Effect 2 and there was Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations. And Butterfly Effect 3 actually released via After Dark Films back in 2009. That was part of their 8 Films to Die For franchise. Pardon me. So, and it's pretty much unrelated to the original film. But all of them kind of have some interesting aspects to them. Playing with, outcomes and, different shit like that. So my curiosity is, of the trilogy, I would say kind of a loose trilogy because Butterfly Effect 2 was kind of like tangentially attached. It was Butterfly Effect 3. So, but my question is, of the three, obviously, Sarcasm says, Eugene would say that the cinematography was awesome or something to that effect. The visual aspect of the film was solid. Maybe. I'm not sure. I think he would probably think that this was actually pretty paint by numbers, that there was nothing really, grandiose about it. Nothing really set it apart, that it was kind of like, we can shoot this thing cheaply. We have some locations. We have some named actors attached to it. The script is not that great, but we can try to make up for it in the visual effects or kind of like the cinematography itself. So maybe. I don't know that he would be that super, jazz about this one because there's just nothing that stands out. So that would be my take on that one. So my question, this one, of the three, Butterfly Effect 2, Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations, of the three, which do you think is the best? And I ask this because Butterfly Effect had, of course, a bunch of named actors to it and was the most money was put into that one. Butterfly Effect 2 is not great. It's pretty fucking trash. But Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations was not bad. Was, I would consider, a significant improvement over the second film. But so some people might dig the third one over the first one. Because in that one, in the third one, lesser known actors, more emphasis was put on the plot itself and in the writing. So a little bit stronger in that one. So let us know down in the comments below or weekinhorror@gmail.com. Which of the three Butterfly Effect films do you think is the best one of the three? And let's do a bonus one as well. Do you think this franchise could be revisited, knowing what we know today? Given what we know today, kind of like our more detailed knowledge of this concept, given that it's a bit more, people are more familiar with it. So I'm kind of curious. consider it a bonus question. Could this franchise be revisited? Now, I would say maybe not with a fourth one, maybe a new one. Just a new one overall, maybe a reboot. Possibility. I don't know. There's storytelling, you know, I wouldn't say it's gold, you know, but there is something that could be mined there. Interesting concept. The concept itself never died. Oh, pardon me, never dies. So, Sir Catherine says, of the three, Donnie Darko was the best. It really was. Ooh, reboot, yes. Ah, but Travis Brown says, hell no. So, Ronald Sam says, not much new to explore on the idea. True, that's possible. Yeah, definitely. And Sir Catherine says, I would really like to see a reboot with better actors. This is definitely one of those ones I think could definitely be rebooted. I think it really, really could. It could be rebooted and made better with less emphasis on, I would say, take more of a primer move to it. Put it more in that direction than instead of trying to focus on, you know, pretty people playing dark roles. I think that would be the important thing. Solid sci-fi concept. I agree, Tony Regime. Absolutely. All right. So let's move on to our next one. And I hope that you all got to see this because this one, Butterfly Effect in Space. Yes, thank you, Ronella's name. Because this one is scary as fuck. You know, it really, really is. And there's so much going on by this one. But anyway, we're going to dive into this one. Released January 25th, 2003. We have actually the third installment in the Ju-on franchise, Ju-on the Grudge. Let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. Yes, that was the trailer for Ju-on the Grudge. So, written and directed by Takashi Shimizu and starring Megumi Okina, Masaki Ito, Takashi Matsuyama, and Yui Ichikawa. The film is actually the third installment in the Ju-on series, but was the first to be released theatrically. The first two films were direct-to-video productions, or what are called V-cinema. So those are direct-to-videos. This one was the one that dropped, and the reason this one got actually dropped a little, the reason it got a theatrical release for the third film is because of the popularity of the movie The Ring. So Ring came out, and then there's you know the expiration of the Grudge franchise or the Ju-on franchise, because originally it was Ju-on the Curse, and then Ju-on the Curse 2. And then, of course, Ju-on the Grudge, which the first one that to drop this one, and of course, is arguably, I would say today is arguably one of the greatest Japanese horror films to have ever been released, to have ever been made. Even though when it first came out, Ringu was actually more popular. So the film itself, obviously, for those who are not familiar, it says, you know, Josh Lee says, then we Americanized it. So for those who are not familiar with the storyline goes at a house in Narima, Tokyo. There is a family that lives there, the Sakae family. Takeo lives there with his wife, Keiko, and their son, Toshio, and their family cat, Mar. And one day, believing that his wife has been having an affair, Takeo murders his wife and his son and the family cat in the grip of an incredible rage, in a fit of rage, and then kills himself, and then unalives himself. And then, of course, out of that tragedy, out of that that horror, a kind of curse is born in the house. And so the ghosts then become vengeful spirits that transforms the spirits into vengeful spirits that infect whoever comes into the home or whoever comes into contact with them and will follow them wherever they go to mete out their vengeance. And then in turn, those individuals, when they die, either their bodies vanish or they don't vanish. But, you know, when those individuals die under those horrific circumstances, that then creates new curses that then infect the areas where those people died. And then it spreads out like a virus. The idea is based upon an ancient kind of like legend regarding, those who die in the grip of either extreme tragedy or extreme anger or an extreme fear, that the individual's death could leave a lasting effect on the world around them and alter them in really, really terrifying ways. So this third film, the things that set this thing apart. Now, obviously, this one came out in 2003. Shortly after this, there was an Americanized remake that came out with Sarah Michelle Gellar, and the American remake was not bad. I enjoyed it predominantly because SMG was in it. You know, SMG is one of my big crushes. But there were a lot of visual elements that were maintained in that. And not to mention, some of the effects were a lot better. Overall, the film itself just physically looks better. The cinematography was a lot stronger. And it was just a cleaner looking film. And plus had some really, really, you know, they kept a lot of the really terrifying shit. But going back and watching this one, especially being the third one, if you haven't seen the first two, you don't really need to watch the first two films because they provide Ju-on Curse and Curse 2 really just provide a little bit of backstory and just a little bit more detail. But you can start right at the third film, which is the first theatrically released one. And you pretty much, you'll recognize it from there. A lot of the stuff in the American version was kept in this one, but it was kept from this one because those visuals were absolutely terrifying. I think, but with Ju-on, with this original theatrical one, this right here is horror done correct. It's like, this is how you do it. Whether you're doing jump scares or whether you're doing just psychological horror where it's just the imagery in and of itself, everything about the film is pitch fucking perfect. The timing on it, the buildups, the tension, not to mention some of the jump scares, whether their hands coming out or it's someone slowly rising up in front of the camera, or it's, you know, the thing that sells this one and a reason it works so well is because the filmmakers Shimizu allows the elements to work for him in the film. The elements in and of themselves. If you notice, one of the greatest things about the film in and of itself is that there is no real backing track to the whole thing. Unlike the American version, where there was always a seeming kind of like a backing scoring that allowed the tension to ebb and flow as necessary for American audiences, is not really present in the Japanese version. The Japanese version feels much more grounded in reality than the American one does. The American one has its flashiness and has that kind of like slick American polish to it, but it is the grit, the grain, and the I would say the rough grounding of the original one of this one that really, really drive it. The fact that the colors are somewhat muted, one of the things that was also really, really brilliant was the differentiation between things that are shot outside the house, things that are shot inside the house, which allows those colors to kind of blend to create the otherworldly environment that the ghosts do inhabit. And of course, you know, how they bring that with them, they carry that with them through the cinematography and the lighting choices and the sound choices as the ghosts follow certain images, like when she's following, Hitomi dies after Kayako follows her to her office and then into her apartment and then gets her there. So there's like really, really terrifying shit. And I love the way that it plays out in a very, very realistic fashion, despite the fact that, you know, it's vengeful spirits. It's the color, it's the sound or lack thereof. It is the elements that are going on around that allow for that honest reflection of Japanese culture, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, because we don't need that big, we don't like need, I would say Shimizu does really well in not like leading the audience by the hand, and that these things happen organically and really, really powerfully, which is why I think this one is so much better than the American one could ever be, because there are just too many cinematography tropes and too many things that we've come to expect as an American audience that take away from the overall explosive and, I would say, growing tension of this original film. But that being said, the movie is scary as absolute fuck. So if you haven't had the opportunity to see this one and you like, and I would say an almost minimalist style, where just the brief moments, allowing the idea of ghosts to work for you is really, really good. And not to mention the acting is fucking phenomenal. If you can tolerate subtitles, or if you don't have subtitles, you can just listen to watch the original Japanese one and kind of piece it together yourself. But I don't think the subtitles are that distracting at all. Sir Cat says, there are only a handful of subtitle films that won't put me to sleep from reading the subs. This, I would say this is one of them. Yeah. Sir Little Wolf is here. Good to see you, Sir Little Wolf. Thanks so much for being here. Sir Calvin says, the tension building in this one is truly done to perfection. The jump scares are always a relief, and that's how they should be used. Absolutely. And it was, it's a relief. It was so nice to not get audio cues before every single fucking jump scare. While there are a number of them here, the typical American formula is to give the audio cue right before the jump in order to, you know, to prepare you for that one. That they didn't play that in this one. That's just not in their style. And I really, really love that fact because it makes it so much more realistic and it grounds it so much better. Not to mention when there's not so much going on the screen or in the background or like with the backing track, your brain has the ability to, you have the opportunity to really focus on what's happening as well as not to mention with characterization, but what's going on in the environment, what's going on with shadows, what's going on with the minimalistic lighting or the very, very basic and minimalist color palette that Shimizu uses for this. So, which I think works extremely well. So that was the kicker on this one. That's why this movie is utterly fucking terrifying. It's bone chilling horror done absolutely right. And there's a reason why it gave birth to this amazing franchise. Yes, there are actually more American versions, you know, given that. And of course, I think it jumped the shark a little bit because it actually eventually led to Kayako versus Sadako, which is the Grudge versus the Ring, which is completely unnecessary. It's just, you know, shit like that. But yeah, Shudder released a crossover of the girls from Ringu and the Grudge. Yes, it was Kayako versus Samara, and that was Sadako. It was Kayako versus I think it was basically Kayako versus Samara, which was Ring versus the Grudge. And not good at all. That was just silly. Yeah. Utterly terrifying. Absolutely was. But here's the question. I know a lot of you out there have probably not seen the first two films, Ju-on the Curse, Ju-on the Curse or Curse 2, which I strongly recommend, even though they were directed to video. I strongly recommend checking it out. Sir Little Wolf says, Ring versus Grudge, good movie. It was fun. I guess some people enjoyed it. I suppose. I didn't. I thought it was just silly. You know, silly fan service is what it was. But if you haven't had an opportunity to see those two, definitely check them out. Although you don't need to see them to understand what's going on in the original Ju-on. So my question is this. There were a lot of elements in the American version that I thought were really, really well done. And they maintained a lot of stuff and they did their best to recapture a lot of those elements, and the sparing use of CGI worked to its advantage, and they did not overdo it, not to mention the acting, you know, Bill Pullman, Sarah Michelle Gellar, and the rest of the cast, and that one I thought were actually quite good. So not to mention the sequences of what was going on in the house were scary as well, not to mention the CCTV camera sequence still gets me every fucking time, and I thought it actually looked better in the American version than it did in this one. Because just the lack of just, you know, like the lack of just the less quality cameras that they had kind of played against that one, but only slightly. It's not even a black mark against the film. I just think it plays a little bit better in the American version. So my question for the audience is this. Given what we know about this one now, and given and comparing it to the American version, and I want to ask. Let's consider this one the original, and then we have the American remake, the one that came out in 2004. Here's my curiosity. Which one, in your opinion, is scarier? Which one was scarier? The original Ju-on the Grudge, technically it would be the third one, or the American remake with Sarah Michelle Gellar and Bill Pullman that explores the idea, basically just Americanizes the caretaker. The caretaker role. It's really the only major difference. Otherwise, a lot of the same elements were the same in there. So let me know down in the comments below which one you thought was scarier. The original one, the original Ju-on the Grudge, or the American remake of The Grudge. Because both of them, I think, have a lot of positives going for them. And it's only because of what American director, this is what's wild, is because the remake was, I believe, if I remember correctly, and I don't want to, yeah, the remake was directed by Takashi Shimizu as well. So, and it was produced by Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert. So, you know, good production going in, which is why the only reason I think that it works. But Shimizu really showed that he had the ability to direct for an American audience as well. So it's still his mind behind it, just for an American audience, whereas the original was done solely for, you know, pretty much, you know, for Japanese audiences. So my question is, given it's the same director and he wrote it, he knows it, you know, he had the production quality and the money behind him for the American remake, which is probably why he was able to shore up things, do things a little bit different, but still capture the nuances and the horror of the original. But, you know, there's something about the original itself. So let me know down in the comments below or weekendorder@gmail.com which one you thought Shimizu did better, or which one was scarier of the two. You know, because he got to direct his remake. So there we go. The original Ju-on or the American version of The Grudge. Really, really curious what people think about this one, because it's fascinating shit. That one really has to be experienced. Really, the Grudge has to be experienced. And I know so many people are familiar with the American remake, but I want people to watch this one to really get a taste of where that horror was coming from. Absolutely. All right, we got one more to talk about tonight, and this one is a super fucking weird one. It is so weird. Oh, it really, really is, I swear. But this one released January 27th, 1989. And we have the dark comedy with, you know, surrealistic horror comedy Parents. So before we dive into this one, yeah, this one is so fucking weird. It's, you know, like, it's, I swear, it's Fido by way of Blue Velvet. I will dive into that one, but let's check out this trailer. Cue up the terror tube. Yes. Oh, yes. Sir Little Wolf. Randy before he went crazy. So that was the trailer for Parents. Directed by Bob Balaban and written by Christopher Hawthorne and starring Randy Quaid, Mary Beth Hurt, Sandy Dennis, and Brian Medorsky. The film follows is set in the late 50s, 1958. The Lemley family just recently moved from Massachusetts to a Californian suburban neighborhood where Father Nick, played by Randy Quaid, works in a mortuary. And his wife, Lily, is a homemaker. And, 10-year-old son Michael begins to question, like, what exactly is on the plates, begins to suspect that his parents may actually be cannibals. So this one is so, like, okay, so on its face, you think Randy Quaid, Mary Beth Hurt, and it's like 1950s. So initially, like, looking at it, you may get the sense it feels very much like, you know, like in the vein of like Fido, where it's like kind of exploring that kind of black comedy in, you know, the set in the 1950s. But I will give it this: this one is extraordinarily weird because of the way Balaban decided to shoot this one. Now, this was Balaban's debut film, but this was not his first, like, you know, his first, like, work ever. He was a frequent actor with Christopher Guest and, of course, has done a bunch of stuff behind the, you know, as far as production goes, and has done a bunch of stuff behind the camera. But this was his first attempt at, like, you know, directing a film himself. This was, like, his directorial debut. Now, knowing what we know about Balaban, I would not have expected this kind of movie from him. I would have expected something completely different because, you know, given the individuals he's worked with, he worked with so many, with movies that he's worked on would be like Catch 22, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Altered States, 2001 A Space Odyssey, and 2010. Supporting roles he worked with, you know, individuals like, you know, you name someone he worked with. It's a legendary dude, Bob Balaban. And co-produced movies like Gosford Park and such. But then all of a sudden, this movie Parents came out. And Parents, initially, I thought was going to be kind of like a goofy, silly comedy in that respect. But I have to admit that Balaban took, I think, a larger page out of his book from I would say, oh, how did I lose his name? I'm thinking Randy Quaid. Now I'm thinking Dennis Quaid. It's not, you know, son of a bitch. I done fucked up. I done fucked up. Son of a bitch. Damn it. I can't remember. I can't believe I totally fucked up. David Lynch. Took a definite page out of David Lynch because there are so many parallels to Blue Velvet in this from both a cinematography perspective, from a storytelling perspective, and from the narrative aspect of generational, of intergenerational trauma. So that, and then the sequences, like the dream sequence when Michael is imagining his dad, you know, it's like freaking blood everywhere. And his mother's like this bloodthirsty, psychopath. And then when the shit eventually hits the fan, the sequence down there in the basement, when the guidance counselor is brought in and they discover the body and so much, I think, was deeply inspired by Lynch's work in Blue Velvet with the performances of Kyle MacLachlan and, of course, with Dennis Hopper and Laura Dern and what was going on in that one, in the exploration of intergenerational trauma. In that, I think, given that this film came out in 1989, and given how the film ends, because ultimately it all comes to a head once Michael figures out what's going on with his parents. He eventually turns on them. And then when the father eventually like loses his shit because he's a freaking maniac, then, tries to kill him. Then the mother kills, the dad, and then he kills her, or mother tries to kill the dad. The dad ends up killing her. And then, the kid ends up burning the place down, trapping the dad in the basement and burning the place down, and then going to live with his grandparents. And then it ends with his grandparents. And then the grandparents giving a big ass sandwich, leaving a sandwich, next to Michael's bed, indicating that the shit that went down, like the cannibalism thing, has been passed down from generation to generation. Now, I honestly think I dug this. I dug this in this respect because Balaban took this opportunity, or I would say Hawthorne took the opportunity to tell a story about how one generation informs the next, and how you have, even though it's like technically it's 1958, and Michael is going to be a member, is going when he grows up, if he's not too traumatized, he's going to be a member of the counterculture when that comes up, considering that his parents are both dead. He's now with his grandparents. And so I think what Hawthorne was trying to do in this one was tell a story about how the boomer generation, the greatest generation, and the boomer generation were essentially feeding off of what everybody else was doing in order to maintain their own status quo. And basically, the way they view the world is that in that whole kind of like Leave It to Beaver, father knows best, father's the head of the household, mom's, Susie Homemaker, and then the kids are better seen, not heard, and that this is the behavior that is expected and is maintained in the family, in the nuclear family, in that kind of outfit. And so, but in order to maintain that kind of rigid, that rigid social dynamic within the household, that the power has to come from somewhere, and that the individuals of the members of the boomer generation, the baby boomers themselves, maintain that by essentially devouring or eating the those around them that would supplant that, that may seek to supplant them or seek to take their power away. And that this is learned from the kind of like pick you up by your by your bootstraps mentality of the greatest generation, how each one breaks the next one in order to maintain the power that they've had. But the counterculture idea of coming up, the 10-year-old son who rebels against his parents, who begins to ask questions and begins to buck the norm, and then eventually comes into conflict with them, eventually supplants the parents, but then realizes that the real power is still around, that the grandparents are still there, and he's still not escaped. So I think what Hawthorne was doing was talking about how the break point between the greatest generation and the baby boomer and the boomers on one side, and what would eventually become the counterculture revolution, or the leading into Gen X, in between there was the greatest. I'll make sure I get my generations correct, because somebody will get mad at me if I don't. So, but moving there all the way to what we would have from the I think Gen X would be Michael's kids, I think is what that would be, or maybe Michael would be a 10. Said no, he would. I think he'd be Gen X. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But essentially, it's the trauma that is left down from each generation before it leading into the next one, and how the counterculture is the one that rebelled against the generation that was left behind by Mary Beth Hurt and by Nick and Lily's generation. So, say off my generation. Gen X started in 1965. So yeah, if he was 10 in 1958, then he would, you know, he was born in 1948. So he's pre, would he be the boomer generation? Because Greatest Generation World War II. So he would be that 1950s. Oh, I hate Greatest Generation, boomers, then Gen X. So Greatest Generation leading to the boomers, and then the boomers leading to Gen X, and how that travails, how that intergenerational trauma keeps getting pushed to the next one as each one has to deal with the trauma of the one left behind. So that's what and it explores this in a number of ways. I think the weirdest was the exploration of understanding that your parents are individuals in and of themselves, and the whole sequence when he accidentally viewed them having sex, and then how that coupled with the idea of when he saw his father doing his job at Toxico, the name of the company he's working for, which itself is kind of a nod to that, I would say to the military industrial complex. So there's a lot of little details going on here, because at this point, how much can we, because there's a point where that we don't know how much we can trust Michael and how he's internalizing these things and how he's viewing his parents as something more than what they are. But then it turns out that they are exactly what he thinks. But yeah, how we internalize these things and how we grow up, you know, you can say it's also a bit of a coming of age. It's a very, very, very weird fucking movie in the way that it's shot. The black and white sequences of the black and white dream sequences, not to mention the interior decor of the house, juxtaposed against the exterior of what's going on. Everybody outside is cookie cutter. Everybody is the same. And everybody has the same family dynamic, whereas the inside of the house has all these hallmarks of things being completely chaotic and out of control. Namely, the sequence in the what I love, it was the beautiful setup, was in the kitchen, which eventually when you see that squiggly, you know, art deco bullshit that's all over the fucking walls, but then leads to this really, really brilliant sequence when they're finally trying to convince him for the last time, you know, it's like, you know, that this is where things are. And they do the sequence where the whole thing is spinning. That was so fucking Lynchian across the board when they're doing the circle around the deal. And it goes to show that it's absolute chaos in the background, that his parents are completely unhinged. And because things are centering around him, he's the only one that's stable in that entire sequence. And so I thought that that was a really, really nice way to emphasize the break in between. That break between, you know, I just don't understand kids these days. Just like that they just, you know, they question things and they, you know, they don't fall in line. That's that whole point, is that we view them as separate from ourselves when we learn that they're separate individuals. And that's where I think Hawthorne was trying to go with this one, was to express it in this really, really weird Lynchian way that kind of like dives a little bit more into the emotion of it than into the fact that, you know, his parents are fucking eating people. And it's, you know, to fairly gruesome effect, I will say this. Definitely. Oh, man. But yeah, it's a weird one. It's a super, and at some points, really, really intense. And I found it really interesting that Hawthorne wrote it and Balaban shot it so that we, the audience, even though Michael is kind of like an unreliable narrator at times because we don't know how much he's fabricating in his own mind or how much he's kind of like trying, you know, like, because the kid is played as having an extremely overactive imagination, but we, the audience, are never, you know, it's never in question whether, you know, what the parents are doing. We know that they're cannibals. You know, they play it from the top. And I found it to be intriguing because allowing someone like Randy Quaid at the time to dive right into a character like that with no buildup, with no character arc, whatever, but this is what he is, allowed him to take that thing in such a manic way that I thought was really inventive. So Balaban took a really big risk with that, but told a really fascinating story. So Sarcastic, I love the way this was shot. The spiraling set at dinner table, the high focus on the meat every time was served, the shot looking up from the meat to their faces, beautiful cinematography. Basically, the way he juxtaposed like what we would think of as like, it definitely makes you look at food in a new way. And there was some really like, even though it should be this, even though you know it's people, you know, there's always something off about it, whether it's the colorization or whether it's the way light hits it. Really, really fun, really, really funky. So, but yeah, I will say this one. it's an interesting and bloody way to explore the intergenerational trauma. And I think that if it wasn't for the artistic elements that Balaban brought to it, you know, given the pedigree of individuals that he'd worked with in the past, and all of the legendary people that he learned from, I think this movie wouldn't have been the kind of like, you know, the unsold gem that it was. Because if you hadn't, this one's available on Tubi. You can check it for free. You know, check it out for free there. I strongly recommend it. There's some squirmy moments in it, no doubt, because of just the way that Balaban like looks at food and that respect and how he shoots it. So Gen X meets the flames. So guys, I want to count every time meat was said. Oh, so many times. You know, you'd be a drinking game out of that one. So, but given the strangeness of this one and how Lynchian Balaban came across and how he was and how he played with reality to a degree in that kind of very, very, I can only say Lynchian in this, you know, and how it could have been. I'm really, really curious. Now, it is a black comedy, although I would say the laughs are nervous laughs at best, because Quaid comes off as so fucking creepy and Mary Beth Hurt comes off as so, you know, malignantly unhinged, like just under the surface. Like, you know, like that whole adage of like, you know, it's all under the surface in suburbia. In suburbia, it's like the crazy is just under the surface. Well, it's like next level in this particular fucking. But her darkness, her malevolence, her bloodthirsty malevolence, with Randy Quaid's fucking manic. You did like complete total psychopath. And then playing those roles in the way that they did, in the way that it was shot, with the color palettes it was shot, I think puts this up there. So I kind of wanted to ask the audience, for those who got a chance to see this one on Tubi, who's available free on Tubi right now, is what do you think is the best cannibal horror film? I would say best black comedy cannibal horror film, because there's too many cannibal films. Like, there's too many cannibal films like from Italian horror and stuff like this, but this one being a black comedy one. But see, it's weird because I wouldn't even say it's like a black comedy. I wouldn't even go that far, because the laughs are all really, really nervous laughs. Some of them, I think, are kind of like they like stick you with the laugh moment. So I would actually put this one up there a little bit more with like We Are What We Are. There's the question. Best family cannibal horror. Best family centered cannibal horror. So like We Are What We Are. Or there was the other one, Son of a Bitch. Obviously, Texas Chainsaw Massacre plays in there as well. But I think this one plays in a little bit more. So Devin, let us know down in the comments below, what do you think is the best family-centered cannibal horror film? There's some weird ones out there, but this one is so intriguing, you know? Definitely so very, very intriguing. You know, this is one of those ones I wish Eugene and I wish Johnny, and one of them had been here to talk about this one, to provide a little bit more insight, because I saw it in a particular way and I know that Eugene would see things that I didn't see, and so would Johnny. So I'm really curious as to what they would think, really. Ooh, Spider Baby. Spider Baby is an excellent one, and recently just got remade, by the way. So, okay, I'm looking forward to seeing the remake. I love the original because it had Sid Haig in it, but I love the original one. I can't wait to see the remake. But definitely let us know down in the comments below. I'm very curious. Best family-centric or family-centered cannibal horror. You know, so there's some weird ones out there, definitely. Like Wes Anderson meets Wes Craven. Very true. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's an excellent point. Raven Dark Story. This reminds me of the kid in the Twilight movie, the way it's shot. Yes. Very interesting in that respect. I like that. I like that that connection you made right there. Definitely, I would say a Twilight Zone, almost Outer Limits style feel, if it wasn't for the David Lynch effect, I think it would come across. So, yeah. So, man, so many weird elements that went in this one. Balaban kind of outdid himself. Very odd for a guy who would go on to write children's books, which is what he currently does now. So, you know, still waters, man, definitely. Oh, buddy. Oh, son of a... Oh, well, I guess this is going to be an easy one. Well, yeah, that's the last one we have to talk about tonight. And what was it? Someone said, well, you know, oh, so that, blah. that was the last film we had to talk about tonight. So, of course, given that's the last one we have, you know what time it is. It is the usual time. It's trivia time. Yes, it is trivia time. So, we got about 220 minutes. Not bad. Not bad. I probably ran a little fast, you know, tonight. We've got about 20 minutes left in the show, but that's okay. Yes, it is trivia time. So, be the first one in the live chat to get the correct answer to this one. And I'm just realizing that I gave away the answer earlier in the show. I did. So, but the question is, what's the question? Is it? What's the question? That's the question. The question is, tonight, if you get the correct answer to this one, be the first one in the live chat with the correct answer, and you will win something special from the Week in Horror store from our Teespring. So, are you ready for this? Because I accidentally gave it away earlier. I didn't even realize that I did it. And this is what happens when it's a solo show. You know, I don't get to, like, you know, punch myself. You know? But nonetheless, trivia question tonight. So get those Google fingers ready, or maybe just those memories going, because I actually gave this to you. So, in which season did Spookies writer Frank Farrell appear on Week in Horror? In which season did Spookies director Frank Farrell, Spookies writer Frank Farrell appear on Week in Horror? First person with the correct answer in the live chat. This should be fast. I totally gave it away earlier in the show. Make sure I got it. Make sure I got it. Yes, Sarcasm had it first. That's right. Sarcasm, it was season 3. And Tony Regine was right behind with season 5. Glober Mom had season 3 as well. Andrew Rivera had second season. Left Hand Jedi had 3. So, yeah, well, a lot less 3s than I anticipated. But, yeah, congratulations, Sarcasm. Let me make sure I got your name down, Sarcasm. Awesome. Yes, it was in season 3 that we had Frank on the show. That Frank came on to talk about Spookies and all kinds of stuff. So, good listening there. I cannot believe I gave it away. It was supposed to be so much more intense. It was supposed to be like, you know, people going back and looking at stuff. So, and by the way, Sarcasm, thank you again for gifting another 5 memberships to the Army of the Dead. I do appreciate that support. So that's 10 that he gifted in this episode. So thank you very much, Sarcasm. You rock. And we will get that, and we will get that prize printed and shipped to you ASAP. So well done. Yes, it was season 3. And be sure to check out that After Dark. The After Dark sit down with Frank was really, really fun. It was a lot of really interesting stuff about the movie Spookies, which I think that y'all might enjoy very, very much. All right. Well, I did run a little quick tonight, a little quicker than usual, because I wasn't, yeah, I was more energy, and I guess I was moving fast. Plus, I'm excited to hear what Eugene and Johnny have for us tonight. But That Horror Fiends is going to conclude this episode of the Week in Horror podcast. I know it was quick. I want to thank each and every single one of you for joining me. I truly hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, smash that like and subscribe button and be sure to hit that bell so that you never miss a future episode. Join us next week when we look back at the British eco-horror Venom, the creepy horror remake of the Uninvited, the inspired French legend horror Brotherhood of the Wolf, and the 60s Poe-inspired macabre horror Night Tide, which is, by the way, Dennis Hopper's first film. Be sure to check out Josh Olson's store at badsamurai.store. He does all the awesome artwork. He's splattered all over our merchandise, which you can find over at Teespring. And for more from Week in Horror, check out all the bloody links that are down in the description. You can follow us on the socials for the daily splatter. Join our Discord for watch parties, big announcements, and all kinds of horror shenanigans, and support the show through channel memberships here, super chats, PayPal, or even through our Patreon for as little as $1 a month. What are you waiting for? Join us. Be a part of what we've got going on behind the scenes. And as always, I want to thank each and every single one of you for being the greatest audience a horror film podcast could possibly have. I've been JL. Thank you all so much for hanging out with me. We will see you all next week. And as always, stay scared.